Welcome to episode 3 of VersantCast, the Medical Physics and Radiation Safety Podcast. Today our guest is Dr. Alan Fellman, a senior health physicist with NV5 Dade-Moeller and a member of the Dade-Moeller Training Academy faculty. Dr. Fellman earned a doctorate degree in radiological studies from New York University in 1989 and attained certification in comprehensive health physics from the American Board of Health Physics in 1995. Dr. Fellman's career in health physics has been focused in the areas of environmental radioactivity, radiation measurements, regulatory compliance and education, radiation safety program compliance evaluations for NRC and agreement state, biopharmaceutical, biomedical, fixed and portable gauge, and well logging licensees. Dr. Fellman was the academic dean for the Health Physics Society 2016 Professional Development School. He has also provided written expert testimony to the U.S. Senate Committee on the Environment on behalf of a client on potential dose implications related to disposal of low-level radioactive wastes at unlicensed facilities. He has served as an expert witness on behalf of several litigants on cases involving radioactive materials and radiation health effects. In today's episode, Dr. Ramsey and Dr. Fellman have a spirited discussion about linear no-threshold. They discuss not only its history, but evidence for the LNT model and the increasing scientific evidence against the LNT model's efficacy. They also touch on the topics of sustainable and nuclear energy, radiation hormesis, as well as the shared hope for advancements in the health and medical physics community. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, Dr. Fellman. Thank you so much for being here. This is the Versant podcast series, and today we'll be discussing the linear no-threshold model, or hypothesis, as some people say. But again, thank you for being here. How are you doing?
Hi, Eric. Nice to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
So, what exactly is health physics, and what does a health physicist do?
Health physics is kind of a misleading term for a lot of people because it doesn't really get at what we do. The best way to describe the practice of health physics is to use the words radiation safety. So health physicists are radiation safety specialists. The name is, as I say, it's misleading, and that stems from where it came from historically. I mean, all of this type of work kind of grew out of the Manhattan Project prior to and during World War II. And at the time, people who were involved in radiation safety as it pertained to the development of nuclear weapons, it was all hush-hush. And so the powers that be at the time actually chose a name for that described that type of work that was intentionally misleading, so as to not kind of indicate what exactly the people involved were actually up to. And the name has just stuck with us ever since. So what does that translate to now? Health physicists are apt to be employed in any and all industries where people are working with radioactive materials or radiation-generating machines such as X-ray devices. Depending on what we're talking about, many entities that do this kind of work need to acquire a license to possess radioactive materials. They need to implement radiation safety programs that are designed to keep workers safe, make sure that all work with radiation and radioactive materials are done within the rules and within the license conditions that are established, and the health physicist is a key person in helping attain those goals.
I see. Well, given its genesis, it seems that there would be quite a range of tasks that a health physicist may be engaged in. For example, if it's in the nuclear industry versus in a radiation oncology facility, it could be quite different.
Absolutely. There are all different sorts of industries and applications, and in fact, it's the kind of thing where many health physicists end up working in one or a couple of areas or subspecialties. So they may be very experienced, for example, at health physics in the medical setting, and have no experience in so far as health physics how it's applied in the energy sector. Or you might have some where the experience is health physics in a biomedical research type of environment. So there are lots of different industries and applications for radioactive materials, which then translate into the health physicist role at those specific types of facilities.
Well, given the range of experience needed to do those different types of activities, is the educational background a constant for all of them, or is it different between the different activities? And is the certification processes, so for example, one can be a certified health physicist, does that cover everything, or are there subspecialties that you need to be certified in?
Well, tough to answer that question without a kind of a long explanation, but to some extent, there are some common threads. I mean, radiation is radiation, and so when we're looking at it from a protection, a health and safety standpoint, protecting the worker, protecting the public, our bodies don't really care if the gamma ray or the beta particle or the X-ray, they don't care if it's coming from a naturally occurring material out in the oil field, as opposed to a fission product that was created in a nuclear reactor. And so for a lot of the knowledge, the academic knowledge, the basics of the field, we need to understand radiation, and we need to understand how radiation interacts in living tissue. And that's going to be common for whatever type of application you have. But having said that, when we look at the actual practice, certainly in certain areas, you need specific expertise, for example, to be a good health physicist in a medical setting. There are several modalities used in the clinics and in the hospitals that are unique that, you know, the health physicist working at a research reactor or at a R&D facility for pharmaceutical manufacturing, or a facility where they use nuclear gauges, they don't need to know the stuff that the health physicist in the medical center needs to know about. So there are these subspecialties that are going to require specific training or specific types of experience. The other thing you mentioned is the certification. And to become a certified health physicist, one needs to pass two pretty comprehensive and challenging exams. And those exams, in terms of the content of the questions, they stretch across everything. And so it's a pretty arduous task to prepare for them, because you do have to review, study about all sorts of areas. Even though once you get out into the real world, you're not necessarily going to be applying health physics in all of those subspecialty areas that you need to know about to be able to be successful on those examinations.
Sure. So today I'm certified as a therapeutic medical physicist. Well, my certification is in therapy physics. When I was in college, I actually didn't know about the field of medical physics. So I entered it quite accidentally when I met a very well-known Canadian medical physicist, Irvin Podgorsak, who introduced me to the field. So in your case, what made you choose this field as a career? Was it a straight line or one of these things where events just unfolded and here you are?
Yeah, definitely the latter. Similar to you, it sounds like, you know, one day you had something in mind in terms of what you're going to do, and then something happened, and next thing you know, you found this new field. And for me, it was similar. I envisioned a career as an environmental scientist. That's where my interest was. I had gone to graduate school and gotten a master's degree in environmental health, and then I went to work for a nonprofit consumer education firm in New York City. And over the course of about a year, year and a half, I started to doubt. I didn't really have a good feel for where my career was headed, because I felt like I knew a little bit about lots of different environmental issues, but I really didn't feel like I was an expert in any one particular area. And about the same time, I met a pretty well-known scientist, health physicist, Dr. Merrill Eisenbud, who was on the board of directors of the organization that I was working for. And Dr. Eisenbud encouraged me to think about going back to graduate school and getting a PhD at the New York University Institute for Environmental Medicine, where he was on the faculty, and his particular lab was the lab for radiological studies. He wasn't necessarily pushing me towards radiological studies, but there were plenty of opportunities for environmental science related research at the NYU Institute. And that's when I decided to take him up on that offer. That's where I thought I would be concentrating. And a funny thing happened on my way to my PhD. It turned out that I didn't really feel comfortable in the lab that I thought I was going to end up in, where I probably would have been doing some sort of air pollution related research. And I just found myself kind of not knowing, like, okay, I've started taking classes to earn credits towards my PhD. But I kind of needed to find a different discipline to focus on. And so I spent my first semester at NYU just kind of poking my head in and out of the various departments and seeing what was going on institute-wise, trying to find my niche. And eventually I settled into the lab for radiological studies, which was pretty much the last place that I ever would have envisioned myself. I was stridently anti-nuclear. This was back in the, I started at NYU in 1984. So I was very much an anti-nuclear energy advocate, and I thought that radiation was pretty much the most toxic thing out there, and was real important to not have it whenever possible. Never in a million years did I think that I would actually work with radiation or in a field that's all about radiation. But just the way things settled when I was at NYU, they had some they had a good program. They had some really interesting professors who I could work with. They had some projects coming up, good research projects with funding, which of course is important if you're a graduate student. And so next thing I knew, there I was coming out 5 years later with a PhD in radiological studies. And that brought me to the field of health physics.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing where you have one attitude and it completely goes 180 degrees and now you're in the field.
Yep.
So you currently work for NV5 Dade Moeller, and as you know, Versant Medical Physics is a spin-off company from Dade Moeller. But can you tell us about both Dade Moeller, the man, a little, and Dade Moeller, the company, and this other company, NV5?
Sure. Dade Moeller, the man, was one of the first-generation superstars in the field of health physics. Very well-known in the health physics community major chunk of his career. Dade was the director of the School of Public Health at Harvard University. And around 1995-ish, give or take, one of Dade's sons, Matt Moeller, who had also followed his dad into the field of health physics, Matt and one of his colleagues decided to start their own consulting firm, which they named after Matt's dad, Dade. And so they basically honored Dade by naming the company Dade Moeller. Initially, it was we went by Dade Moeller and Associates, and then at some point shortened the name to just Dade Moeller. But Dade Moeller was primarily a health physics consulting firm. It grew to be about 175 employees, give or take. Again, the vast majority of the work was in the radiological sciences, but then that did start to change in the 2000s, probably in the 2010 to 2015 time period. The company started to expand into other environmental health and safety disciplines. We started adding some industrial hygienists to our company. And so the IH group became a small but growing part of the company. And then through a series of circumstances, we were able to get involved in some environmental work in the Gulf of Mexico in response to the Deepwater Horizon accident, which prompted us to hire several environmental scientists. And so the company was expanding. And so we had gone from 100% radiation safety to now maybe, 70 to 80% radiation safety with some industrial hygiene and environmental science thrown in. And then, of course, along the way, we started to grow the medical health physics business, which became Versant. That's kind of where we were as of May of 2016, when Dade Moeller was acquired by NV5 Global. NV5 is a much, much larger company, publicly traded company, an engineering and science consulting firm. And I think of them as traditional engineering, the green buildings, transportation infrastructure, oil pipeline design and oversight, all different sorts of different type of engineering applications. But within the company, one of the areas that, which they call verticals, was called environment or the environmental vertical. And I think with the acquisition of Dade Moeller, the thinking was that the company was going to grow that environmental vertical to also incorporate environmental health and safety, which is what Dade Moeller added to the company.
I see. Going back just quickly to your not being in favor of radiation earlier in your life, it's surprising, but there was a time early in the so-called atomic age when nuclear-based energy sources were expected to usher in a utopia of safe, abundant energy and so on. And what happened to change these perceptions, and what happened to you? Why did this future first not materialize, and why did the perceptions around radiations change?
Well, lots of things contributed to that. I think with nuclear energy and why that utopia that you speak of never developed, it has to do with a lot of things, and one of the main reasons is that the linear non-threshold hypothesis became the backbone of radiation safety public policy, and I know we're going to talk about that more in a few minutes, so I'll just throw that out there for now, that the way we regulate radiation kind of hindered the development of nuclear power. But beyond that, what really started to turn the public away from nuclear energy, I think the most important thing was the Three Mile Island accident in 1979, which was the first major U.S. power reactor accident. And of course, that was followed by the Chernobyl accident in the former Soviet Union in the 1980s. And these events turned people basically against this technology. The perception was that it was disastrous for the environment, disastrous impact on public health. The perception was that for the most part, the risk, if not totally unacceptable, certainly was high risk. And so to the extent that we could do away with it, that became the type of thinking that many folks got behind. And the anti-nuclear group out there just grew and grew, pushing their anti-nuclear message. And I was caught up in all that. Like I said, in the 80s, when I went back to graduate school, I believed all that stuff. I remember watching the China Syndrome about the meltdown and how devastating that could be and how likely that it was just a matter of time that something like that was going to happen at a U.S. power reactor. And so I bought what the anti-nuclear crowd was selling. I didn't know any better. And for me, my 180 on it has taken a long time. It's been, three decades of a career where little by little by little, a fact here, a fact there, I'd learn things that sort of flew in the face of the perceptions that I held. You know, it's when you hold perceptions, we all hold perceptions about all sorts of things, and to the person who's holding the perception, well, that's the truth. And then these nasty little facts kept falling on my lap that were basically blowing holes in all these perceptions that I held about radiation and nuclear energy. And little by little, they forced me to start to question what I thought I knew. And it wasn't until, I'll say, about 4 or 5 years ago that that everything kind of crystallized for me. And I finally realized that not only was I wrong in what I thought the evils of radiation were and how they were negatively impacting public health and the environment and the environmental health, but also that those perceptions were actually the cause of a lot of problems. And I'm sure we'll talk about those as we continue here.
Well, I'll make two comments. First, kudos to you for letting facts change perceptions.
Well, I went kicking and screaming. Believe me. I fought them every step of the way, but eventually they just beat me down.
Well, I happen to know a few people for whom their perceptions present a formidable wall to any set of facts you may want to present to them. So that's understandable.
Absolutely. That's the way our minds work.
Sure. And as for nuclear energy, the new existential threat today is global warming. Mm-hmm. It's probably not likely that windmills and solar power will replace the vast amount of energy we need. And so it seems as if nuclear power may be making a comeback, at least in the minds of some people. I know that Bill Gates has invested in this so-called thorium reactor research quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So it's quite possible that things may turn around and the utopia is still to come.
Yeah, I'm guardedly optimistic that what you just said will come to pass. There are a lot of really exciting new technologies. You mentioned one, the thorium reactor. There are small modular reactors that I think could play a really nice role in our energy diverse complex as a way to meet some of the needs and several other new nuclear technologies that hold a lot of practice. But as you started on this topic about climate impact, if we agree, and I do acknowledge that there are some people who don't agree with this, but if we do decide that it is a bad idea to just dump unlimited amounts of carbon into the atmosphere, and if we also agree that we want the light bulbs to go on when we flip the switch, we're not ready to move back into the caves and do away with electricity. So if we're A, going to cut carbon emissions, and B, continue to use electricity, the only way to generate baseload 24/7 electricity to meet the supply and the demand, the only way to do that is with nuclear. I'm not suggesting that the renewables have no role. They certainly do and should have a role in the totality of how we generate electricity. But the fact of the matter is, the sun doesn't shine all the time. The wind doesn't blow all the time. When it does shine and the wind does blow and we're generating maximum amounts of electricity from these, we have a problem storing the electricity on the grid. I recently read that down in California, where they've probably more than any other state increased the percentage of renewables over the last 10 or so years. In California, in the middle of the summer, when the solar farms are generating peak amounts of electricity, California ratepayers have to pay Arizona to take the excess energy off the grid, or else it's just going to dissipate and be wasted. I mean, wrap your head around that.
All right.
California ratepayers have to pay more money because there's all this electricity from the solar panels that is just going to be wasted if they don't find. So the whole storage and distribution and the grid systems and all that stuff comes into play. The fact that you can generate a boatload of solar powered electricity in the desert in California doesn't mean that you can use that to light up the city of Detroit. And so there needs to be a mix, and the solar and the wind needs to have backup. That's always going to be available. And if it's not nuclear, then it's going to be fossil fuels. And so what do we see in a state like California, where they've increased their contribution from renewables? You see increased costs, and you see increased carbon into the atmosphere. Same thing in Germany, where they decided no more nuclear energy after Fukushima. And so they've only got about 5 or 6 power plants that are still running, but they're all scheduled to be decommissioned, or at least shut down to be decommissioned by the end of next year. And what do we see? We see about a 5% increase in the amount of carbon that's emitted to the atmosphere. Why? Because the nuclear plants are replaced with coal or natural gas.
It's a tremendously difficult problem to solve, mostly because of the politics more than anything else. But fusion, people have a hope that fusion will finally make a breakthrough. I think they're building a tokamak in France that will prove it or not. The thing is, from what I observe, the cost of these reactors is enormous, very difficult engineering. And the idea of light bulb fusion reactors, which you may have heard of, I think none of those have worked out yet. So I think nuclear energy, as far as fission products go, that still is going to have to be the way to go.
Right. And it would be nice to say someday fusion, and who knows, maybe someday there will be fusion on a commercial scale. But what's really encouraging is that so many of these next generation nuclear technologies are fission reactors. In addition, we already mentioned the small modular and the thorium reactor. There's also fast reactor technology, which has an advantage of being able to burn up what today we call high-level spent nuclear fuel or high-level radioactive waste that people worry about. Oh my goodness, it's going to be radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years. Well, if you're the engineer designing the fast reactor of tomorrow, you don't look at that spent fuel and look at it as high-level rad waste, big problem. You look at that as fuel.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's stuff that we could, because 90-some% of the energy is still there. The fission reactors that we have right now are not very efficient.
Oh, no.
They don't get that even 10% of the total amount of energy that the initial fuel rods contain. So if we can build the reactor that's going to take that high-level waste problem and turn it into electricity, I mean, what a win-win that could be.
Absolutely. You know, we could keep on that topic for a while, but since we are here to discuss linear no threshold,
right?
You have written a number of papers and presented at multiple conferences on radiation safety, and in particular on the linear no threshold or LNT model/hypothesis. And this topic seems to hold a particular interest for you. Probably has to do with your 180. Mm-hmm. So what exactly is the linear no-threshold hypothesis?
Okay, so the linear non-threshold hypothesis is a mathematical model that is used to predict or to estimate the impact of any dose of radiation. And let me go from the starting point, real data, to the end point, which is a model. Okay, the starting point is that we know pretty well what happens when people or living things, animals, cells, whatever, we know what the impact is on biological systems when exposed to very high doses of radiation. We know that extremely high doses of radiation will be acutely lethal. We know that high doses of radiation are carcinogenic, will increase the incidence of radiogenic cancers. The problem is that what we really need to know when our objective is to set public health policy or worker safety standards, for example, for people working with radioactive materials, the problem is that we don't really know what is the impact of radiation in the low dose range, in the range that people who work with radioactive materials or with X-ray devices, in that range where they get doses from their work. And so what the linear non-threshold hypothesis does is it looks at the relationship between dose and cancer incidence at very high doses, which we know, and then it assumes that the risk is proportional to dose all the way down to zero dose. So we basically take a ruler or a straight edge and we extend the line from the high dose range, again, based on real data, into the low dose range where we don't have data. And we just assume that the starting point of that mathematical relationship is at the XY axis where the dose is zero and the cancer risk is zero. And then we draw a straight line. And so where that model leaves us is that as soon as there is a measurable or a positive radiation dose, there's a positive cancer risk associated with it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we can't measure that. That's not based on any biology. That's simply a mathematical propagation.
Right. So
that's what the LNT is.
Right. So hence the hypothesis that you can use the high dose regime to make predictions about the consequences of receiving dose in the low dose regime.
Right. And there are a lot of problems with that, starting with biology, basic biology, because what we know without any doubt is that biological systems, the way they respond to radiation is apples and oranges when you're looking at a response to a high dose versus a response to a low dose. Entirely different biologically. And so to assume that it's all based on the same relationship, which is what the linear non-threshold hypothesis model does, it refutes basic biological concepts.
In the high dose regime where the model starts, the data is from what? Where is that data from?
Couple of places. We've got a lot of data from what's called the lifespan study, and that is the study of the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the two atomic bombs that were dropped on Japan to end World War II. Over 86,000 persons who have been and continue to be studied, and it's not just the persons who were irradiated but not killed when those bombs were dropped, but also their children and their grandchildren are also part of the study. So this has been going on for 70 years now. That's one example. There are other handful of studies, mostly from, let's say, the first half of the 20th century, when whether it be from accidents or from operations where worker safety was not rigorously studied and you know, safety protocols weren't implemented the way they are today. So there are examples of situations where people would have been exposed to higher doses of radiation for one reason or another. Examples might be uranium miners who inhaled enormously high concentrations of radioactive radon gas and its decay products in the uranium mines, resulting in extremely high doses to their lungs. And when we study those cohorts, we learn about the dose response relationship at high doses between radiation dose and lung cancer. We've got studies of the old radium dial painters from the 19 teens and 20s who ingested very large quantities of radium from their work as individuals painting luminescent radium paint onto watches and clocks and other glow-in-the-dark items. They would ingest a lot of radium. The radium would bind up to the bone. And 50 years later, 60 years later, we have a study of radium dial painters where we're measuring the content of radium in their bone, from which we can estimate dose. And then we compare that to the incidence of skeletal cancer. And so there are several examples like these that provide us with some pretty good knowledge about the impact of radiation dose on cancer incidence at very high dose rates.
I see. Now, in the U.S., the background radiation is about 350 millirems per year, if I'm allowed to say millirems.
Yeah, you can say that.
Yeah, and in different parts of the world, it could be much higher, maybe even lower.
Correct.
So We do have some information at that level of background that spans, I don't know, maybe in some areas, I think there was a beach in Brazil I read once that the background was 1,200 millirems per year.
Yeah, and there's actually, I could be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that the highest of these, you know, the handful of these anomalous high background areas, there's an area in Iran where the doses are much higher, on the order of like 20 to 25 rem per year, perhaps, in some cases.
So we do have data at low dose ranges. So why can't some assessment be made as to the effect of it instead of just doing a first pass straight line study? Has anyone tried to see what the effect on populations are for varying backgrounds?
Yeah, the problem is for low doses, such as in the range of natural background, to do an epidemiological study to really try to better define the actual shape of the dose response curve, you run into problems generating statistical power, given the fact that the background cancer incidence is about 40 to 42%. In other words, if you're a human being, you got about a 42% chance of getting cancer. You have about a 20% chance of dying from cancer. So the background isn't zero. We start with a very substantial background, and then it gets into this signal-to-noise ratio. When you try, let's say hypothetically there was a difference in cancer rates to the population along the East Coast and the Southeast, where Mother Nature provides about 200 millirem a year from natural background. And then you compare them to the population out in the Rocky Mountain region, where they're getting maybe 400 to 500 millirem a year, more than twice the background that we get along the coast and on the eastern part of the country. If there was a little bit of an increase due to that higher radiation dose rate, when you did an epidemiological study, you would never be able to see it because that little increase gets lost in the background variability. And so epidemiology, the study of diseases, comparing them, looking for causal factors, it could only show us so much. And then we get into this problem of just not having enough statistical power.
I see. So the LNT hypothesis or model as it is today, is this accepted by a scientific consensus?
I would say no. I think most scientists do not accept it based on scientific principles. Now, I should distinguish that a lot of people do still feel that it's prudent to use the LNT to establish public health policy, things like standards, dose standards for workers, dose standards for members of the public. I personally don't think that's appropriate anymore. But we need to distinguish. You've got people who think the LNT is garbage and shouldn't be used for anything. Then you've got some people who think there are problems with the LNT, but it's a conservative approach and better safe than sorry rules the day. And so even though I have some problems with it scientifically, I think it's appropriate to use it for setting health and safety standards. And then I think there's a small percentage of scientists who ardently believe that it accurately portrays the actual relationship between low-dose radiation and disease. Certainly, I wouldn't say the majority of scientists concur with the LNT.
It's always interesting to me that you will be able to find a scientist who has a completely opposite view to maybe something that the majority accepts.
Absolutely.
So, for example, you were saying earlier your perceptions got beaten down by facts. Mm-hmm. When we encounter scientists who have a more ardent support for LNT, is this just a case where the facts aren't able to penetrate a perception, or is it something else?
It's a great question that I'll start by saying I struggle to be able to answer it because I think it's an individual thing. So all I can tell you is, in other words, I can't state the motivation of somebody else as to why they believe this. What I find incredibly frustrating is that there is so much literature that's been published over the last several decades that show that the LNT is really not getting the job done. That, in fact, there is apparently a threshold below which there is no cancer risk, or that low doses actually are hormetic or beneficial. In other words, populations receiving low doses of radiation actually see a reduction in their risk of cancer. And it's not until you get upwards of several tens of rem that you start to see the carcinogenicity manifest itself. And so I don't know why, but what I see is that most of this literature is just plain ignored by the pro-LNT crowd, because you don't see that literature refuted, because it's fairly irrefutable. So you don't see it refuted, you just see it ignored. If you don't acknowledge that it exists and you don't include it in the data set that you're evaluating, well, then you can pretend that it's not there. And that's what many of the regulatory agencies have done, and many of the pro-LNT advocates seem to do. What I see is that when papers, and there are some that are published that tend to support the LNT, especially, you know, extrapolated through that low dose range, and they're saying, well, that seems to be demonstrated by these analyses that this particular author might be writing about, there's typically a lot of flaws in their approach. And there have been several papers that have come out following some of these pro-LNT conclusion papers that basically pick them apart and show that through poor faulty design, the way the data are skewed, the way the analysis is done, there are a whole lot of games that are played to make the statistics into something that maybe suggests that LNT is the best way to go, when in fact it's just, you know, sleight of hand. And this goes all the way back to the beginning. I know you didn't actually ask me this, but I think it's important to get this into the conversation. And that is that the whole thing is the whole LNT is built on a house of cards. It all started in the 1950s when the National Academy of Sciences for the first time took a look at this topic of, you know, what's the risk of low dose radiation, with the nuclear age was just beginning. And the LNT became the basis of the public health approach to regulating radiation, based on the Nobel winning work of Hermann Muller, who won the Nobel Prize for his work looking at mutations from X-rays in fruit flies. And what we've learned over the last 10 years through a series of publications, papers written by a toxicologist up at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell named Ed Calabrese, what he learned is that the geneticists of the day, the people involved in with the National Academy back in the mid-1950s, as well as Mueller and his colleagues, basically, they didn't present all of their data. They concluded that the LNT was the appropriate model for these mutations that they were studying, when in fact they never even exposed any of their fruit flies to low doses. They were only hundreds of rem and higher. And so they also learned their motivation. Their motivation was, by skewing the data to make the radiation look more harmful, that would help them obtain future funding for genetics research, which they all agreed was a good idea. And they were also concerned that with proliferation of nuclear weapons, and they thought, if we can scare the hell out of everybody, then maybe that will have a beneficial advantage of tamping down nuclear weapons proliferation, another worthy objective. So they basically exaggerated and obfuscated and didn't provide all the information. And that's what got the ball rolling. And in fact, just today, I mean, it couldn't have been any more timely. I came across a paper that was just published in the January to March 2020 issue of Dose Response Journal about the mega mouse study that was done in the 1950s that, again, now we're not talking fruit flies, now we're talking about mice, but it basically was studies of the hereditary effects of radiation in mice. And the researchers basically covered up the rate of the mutations that were observed in the control group. And by doing that, by not acknowledging all of the mutations in the control group, they made the radiation look 10 times or even more more dastardly in causing mutations than it actually was. And this wasn't uncovered until the mid-90s. So, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff in the literature, and, you know, you start reading it all, and it's pretty remarkable. But it started with faulty data and covering up and not publishing everything that was learned and pretending certain things didn't exist. And that trend has continued for decades.
Scientists covering up data, creating false data.
Yes.
How unusual.
Yes.
Unfortunately. This leads to a host of questions. I'll throw some of them out. So first of all, radiation hormesis. It's established that there is such a thing. So what is the biological basis for that effect?
Yeah, hormesis. Very interesting in my journey and in, you know, knocking down all my perceptions. I first heard the term hormesis, I believe it was the 2006 Health Physics Society's annual conference. And I'm sitting in the audience. They held a special session where they had three members of the National Academy of Sciences BEER-7 committee that had just published the BEER-7 report, which is the latest and greatest on the health effects from low doses of radiation. And the BEER-7 committee ignored all of the literature on radiation hormesis, this idea that low doses might actually be beneficial. They didn't compare it to other data and decide that they didn't like it. They just ignored it. They didn't address it at all. Well, I didn't catch that in looking at the BEER-7 report because I didn't know what radiation hormesis was. I'd never heard of it. But I'm sitting in the audience and they get to this question and answer session. And all of a sudden, there's this guy standing in front of a microphone in the aisle screaming at the panel. And, you know, I'm like jolted out of my stupor because people just don't scream at Health Physics Society conferences. And I'm listening to this guy and he's just taking this panel down. He's taking them to task. How can you sit there and say you did a comprehensive review of this topic when you never even considered any of the literature on radiation hormesis? And I was like, what is he talking about? And I thought that this guy must be a shill for the Nuclear Energy Institute or something like that, until a couple weeks later, I happened to come across a paper that was supportive of radiation hormesis. And I thought, wow, that's a coincidence. That's the same thing that guy was screaming about at the conference last month. And then a few months later, I see another paper and then another and another and another. And here we are, 14 years later. I probably have about 600 papers in my own personal library on my computer that support radiation hormesis and or a threshold below which there's no carcinogenic risk. And I don't keep every paper I see. I delete a bunch of them. So there's just a boatload of literature that supports this concept that low doses of radiation have a beneficial effect. From a toxicological standpoint, the thing that is really important to understand is that this is not an unusual thing. You know, you could hear this about radiation. Okay, you know that radiation can kill you if it's super high dose. We know that it's carcinogenic at very high doses or in some relatively high dose range. How could it be that something that can kill you is actually going to be good for you in low doses? Well, when you study toxicology, what you learn is this is a very, very common pattern of toxicity. Low dose, beneficial. Intermediate dose, no impact. High dose, dangerous. Water. We all like to drink water, and we recognize that if we don't drink water, then we got a problem. Well, it turns out that if we drink too much water, it will kill you. We lost a kid probably about 5-6 years ago, a local kid in the D.C. area where I live in Maryland, where I remember reading in the paper that after a spring football practice, a player on one of the local high schools drank about 5 gallons of water in about 20 minutes, and the next day he died from hyperhydration. So low dose is beneficial, high dose is toxic. How about oxygen in the air? Something that we don't think about much, but we all know that it's a good thing to be breathing some oxygen. At low doses, it's very beneficial to our health. It's essential to our health. But yet, if there's too much oxygen in the air, it can kill you. It will kill you. So lots and lots of things show this pattern of toxicity. And if radiation is one more where low doses are beneficial, but high doses are dangerous, it's just one of many. It's not unique. It's not crazy. It's very common.
Is there some understanding at the cell level or biologically what mechanisms are at work?
Yes. Yeah. I don't think anybody can, you know, put their hand on the Bible and swear to tell the truth and know exactly what it is that makes radiation hormetic at low doses. But from my understanding of the literature and the things that I've read, I see a couple of things, a couple of explanations. One is it stimulates certain genes that are involved in an immune system response. I mean, basically, our cells are under attack all day, every day, from all sorts of things, from all sorts of oxidative metabolic things that are going on in our bodies, causing negative impacts to our cells. And most of the time, the consequence of all these negative events is nothing. We don't get sick all the time. Why? Because we have immune systems that fight back, that clean out cells that are no longer healthy, that fix the damage, repair the damage to cells. And so one of the things that we've seen, is some of the research shows, is that some of these genes that are involved in immune system response are upregulated. In other words, they work more efficiently following low doses of radiation. So that's one way. I've read about radiation having anti-inflammatory effects on living tissue. And now there's actually some researchers taking a look at whether low-dose radiation might be beneficial in treating certain diseases involving inflammation because of that ability to knock down inflammation. So there are several, and you know, those are two. I'm sure there are more things out there in the literature that sort of get at how it is that irradiating living organisms could result in a beneficial outcome.
Okay. Well, let's get back to the LNT from this point of view. So the science that suggests you can draw that straight line from the high-dose region to the low-dose region is questionable at best. Maybe some scientists have been promoting it for reasons that are less than completely straightforward. But so what? So what? Isn't this a safer way to go in terms of public policy? Why is it a big deal if we do this anyway?
I used to think so. I used to, you know, if you asked me that question 10 years ago, I would have said, yep, it's a conservative approach, but better safe than sorry. The precautionary principle, probably a good way to go. And I bought that line of reasoning up until, I want to say 2014, I could be off a year or two, but in and around 2014, I read for the first time about something, a new term as far as I can tell, something that was labeled evacuation-related fatality. And what this was about was an article, a paper written about the folks, the 150,000 people or so who were evacuated after the accident at Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Station following the tsunami in 2011 in Japan. So here we had this nuclear accident, and we had these you know, these buildings explode and there's some radioactivity, a lot of radioactivity released to the environment, impacting a certain, however many hundreds of square kilometers of Japan. And that area was evacuated. And so about 150,000 people had to give up basically everything, leave their homes, their schools, their jobs, their communities. Some of them couldn't take their pets with them. I mean, it's obviously horrific to have to, you know, uproot like that. Well, now we were 3-4 years down the road, and here was a study being published that is showing that because of the physical stressors involved in that evacuation, at the time they were reporting that there were about 1,600 fatalities. So 1,600 real people, moms, dads, grandmas and grandpas, real people were dead. Why? Because they weren't strong enough physically or medically to withstand the rigors of being evacuated. And you could say, all right, well, wait a minute. All right, that's obviously tragic, but didn't we need to get them and everybody else out of that contaminated zone where they would have been irradiated? And then that's where you have to look at the dose levels in that part of Japan that was evacuated. I mean, if the dose levels were hundreds of rem in a year or some, you know, ungodly high dose level, then yeah, at a certain point, evacuation is called for. But it turns out that based on the levels of deposition of radioactivity, in the first year following the incident, the maximum dose would have been about 5 rem in a year, which is the dose that we allow a worker to receive in the United States. It's a dose that has really never been found to cause any negative harm to any population. We're in the low dose range. And the average dose in that first year wasn't anywhere near 5 rem. It was closer to 1 rem. And then with each subsequent year, as the shorter-lived radionuclides decay, the dose rates come down significantly, so where now you're maybe looking at about a 1 rem a year max, with only a tenth or 2/10 of a rem as an average within that evacuated zone. So that was when I realized that this better safe than sorry approach actually has negative consequences. Everything that they did evacuating that population from Japan was to be better safe than sorry. And because of that, we now have 1,600, and by now it's probably more like 2,000 dead people, people who probably would have been alive if they left them where they were to get a dose of radiation that's less than the dose levels where we would expect an impact on cancer rate. So that's the beginning for me of where I realized that this application of LNT really does have negative consequences. And in doing more reading and learning more, I realized that there's more ways that the LNT has negative impact on society. I mentioned a few minutes ago how there's some potential for radiation to be used in a medical setting as an anti-inflammatory agent. There's a whole lot of possibilities for radiation to be used to treat certain diseases, and the research has not been done. The research that should have been done by now hasn't been done. Why? Because of the LNT, because the physician makes a pledge that thou shalt do no harm. And if one photon of radiation can give you cancer, which is what the LNT says, well, then if they're going to do research and that research involves irradiating patients, then by definition, they're doing harm. And therefore, a lot of the research never gets done. So that's another way LNT hurts us. A third way LNT hurts us, we were talking earlier about nuclear power and some of these next generation reactors. Well, the LNT driven regulations significantly contributes to the very high costs of operating, building, constructing, and operating a nuclear power plant. The levels that they have to control, the material that has to be disposed of as radioactive waste, which is very expensive, that in some cases has minimal radiation associated with it. All these things are based on LNT-driven formula and calculations and procedures, and they all add to the cost of nuclear power, which, you know, hey, when push comes to shove, it's a lot less expensive to build a couple of gas and coal plants, and, you know, the environment be damned.
So there may even be another motivation, I suppose, for keeping the L&T model, which is entire industry of people who make a living based on the regulations that the L&T creates.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a definite follow the money component to all of this. Going back, you know, I was talking about some of that, the controversy from the 1950s. One of the things that I just thought of as you were just saying that, was that the Rockefeller Foundation was one of the organizations that provided a lot of the money for these geneticists to do their research. And who were key contributors to the Rockefeller Foundation but the big oil companies? And so who in the 1950s had a huge financial incentive to keep nuclear power from becoming the dominant way we generate electricity in this country? This is the oil and gas industry. So, yeah, they had, a huge financial stake in all of this. And to this day, there's a conflict of interest. A lot of, you know, our government agencies, you know, big bureaucracies that have these big radiation control programs. Well, if we acknowledge that radiation, at least in the low dose range, where we operate environmentally and at work, if we concede that, you know what, radiation isn't really the toxin, the hazard, the carcinogen that we thought it was, well, then maybe my program isn't quite as important as we used to think, and maybe, you know, the funding that's provided so I can run this, you know, 50 person division within this agency, maybe that money would be better spent elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so there's an inherent conflict of interest, especially for the regulators, who are the ones who need to change their approach. Well, they change their approach and they concede that this stuff doesn't have to be so tightly regulated. They're basically cutting their own budget. And so hence the conflict of interest.
It's one thing to demonstrate the failures of L&T, but you need to then tell us what you want to replace it with. And are there alternative models for radiation protection that have been proposed? Do you have something that you're proposing?
I do not have something that I'm proposing. I've seen some people dip their toe in that water. I think it needs to be addressed comparably to how a lot of other occupational hazards are regulated. When we're talking about, you know, the exposure to a toxic chemical that could acutely cause some type of health effect, or something like noise pollution. Let's use noise in the workplace as an example. You know, we look at noise and we recognize that if there's too much noise, the decibel level gets too high, then there comes a point where our hearing is going to be impaired. And obviously, we want to protect our workers and not allow that to happen. So we measure that at a certain decibel level. That's where we expect to see hearing damage. And so we don't regulate at that level. We lower it quite a bit. We build in a nice safety factor and we draw a limit. And we say at this level here, if we live within this limit, no workers are going to be subject to hearing loss. And so if you go and do a noise survey in that factory and you're taking all these readings and you see, let's say you're measuring decibel levels that range from 10% to 50% of the limit, then what do you conclude? You conclude everything's good. We're compliant with our limit. Nobody's being harmed. We don't have to spend an extra dollar to reduce the noise because we're in good shape. But in radiation safety, we don't do that. We can go into the workplace and we can measure 10 to 50%, let's say, of the occupational dose limits. But then what do we have? We have as low as reasonably achievable, which I call the first cousin to the LNT. The LNT brings us to this as low as reasonably achievable philosophy of radiation protection. So not only do we need to comply with the limit, But even when we're in compliance with the limit, then we have to apply this next philosophy, as low as reasonably achievable, or ALARA, and see what can we do to get the doses even lower. So when we measure 10% of a dose limit, but then we spend a buck to get from 10% of the dose limit down to 9% of the dose limit, LNT says we just reduce the risk. I say you just wasted a buck, because the way I see it, you didn't buy any health protection. You went from no cancer risk to no cancer risk. But the LNT encourages us to waste our money and get the levels lower and lower and lower.
Right. And maybe even some small benefit was not obtained if hormesis, is that thing.
Right. Yeah. Then you bring hormesis into it, and then it really makes the whole thing crazy when you start to think, well, geez, you know, maybe if we, instead of lowering it by a percent, if we raised it a little bit, maybe then we're giving the worker the benefit of a hormetic dose. And, you know, that's probably an argument for another day. I think what's more important is let's just get the LNT out of how we do this business of regulating, without trying to build the hormetic dose into it as well. I think you got to walk before you can run.
If the LNT was to be replaced, that would need to be something done in a very serious manner with a group of physicists, health physicists, let's say, that develop a proposal and present it. Are there such groups?
Yeah. In fact, several years ago, I want to say 3 years ago, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is the federal agency responsible for regulating the use of radioactive materials in the workplace, they were presented with three petitioners petitioned the NRC to do away with the LNT as the basis of their regulations. And the NRC hasn't ruled on those petitions either way yet. So, I'm not going to kid you and say I think that the petitioners are going to be successful. I would be shocked if the NRC actually agreed to do that at this point. But they haven't denied the petitions either. So that's a start. As I understand it, and what I've observed, is the regulators have a fallback excuse for not changing the way they do business. You know, they'll look you in the eye and they'll tell you, listen, I agree with you. I agree that the LNT has its flaws. I'm seeing compelling literature that suggests radiation hormesis at low doses, but my hands are tied. I have to follow the law, and we are not allowed to change the law until the authoritative scientific bodies tell us that that's what we should do. So that means the National Academy of Sciences, or that means the NCRP, the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements. Until these scientific bodies tell us that we should do things differently, we can't change the way we do business. And that's the fallback that the regulators hit you with at this point in time. So what's it going to take for the National Academy of Sciences to change, for the NCRP to change? I don't know. I think it's a long road to hoe, and one person at a time, I guess. The more this literature gets out there, the longer it's out there, the harder it's going to be to continue to ignore it. And you can only hope that eventually the pendulum is going to swing in the other direction, where it'll get to the point where you just won't be able to ignore it anymore. And then maybe things will change.
So there's a famous quip attributed to Max Planck, the physicist, and he apparently once said that science advances one funeral at a time. So will changes to the basis of current regulations have to wait until the next generation of physicists?
Probably. I don't know. You know, I've had this conversation with lots of folks, and it gets to, well, do you think it'll ever change? And I say optimistically, yes. And then the next question is, when do you think it's going to change? And to that, I certainly don't have the crystal ball. And I don't know how long I have to live if I'm going to actually be alive to see the day come when we do away with the LNT as the basis of worldwide radiation safety. It could be many decades from now. No way of knowing. But one thing that I came up with, and, you know, time will tell, you know, we can look back 50 years from now and time will tell if what I'm about to say proves to be true. But I like to draw two comparisons. If 40 or 50 years ago, you told me or I told you that the day was going to come that two men could legally get married or two women could legally get married in this country, and then when they're celebrating their wedding, they can go and legally smoke some marijuana, you would have looked at me and, you know, like, what is he smoking?
Right.
But now you look at the world today, and both those things, which were so outrageously ridiculous so many years ago, are now the law of the land. So I like to think just maybe this use of the LNT is maybe where gay marriage and legal marijuana were 30 or 40 years ago. And again, time will tell.
You know, that's quite a comparison between those two areas. So there is an abundance of information available on the internet today. A lot of it is fake news, I guess, about radiation and its risks. And, you know, the information that you can find spans the spectrum from reasonable to unreasonable. And given the difficulty of fake news and knowing what's real information and what's given because someone has an agenda, and information that's completely fabricated is often put out there. Are there preferred websites or places that you could recommend the general public to go if they want to get reliable information on radiation safety, if they want to understand better the linear no threshold without reading academic papers?
Yeah, there are a couple of good resources online. One is the website of an organization called Scientists for Accurate Radiation Information, of which I am a member. The website is Radiation Effects, one word, effects is plural, .org. Another good and particularly relevant place to look for information is the website of the XLNT Foundation. And you can find them at x-lnt.org. And a third place to look, and this is more about nuclear energy and its role, not quite as much as, you know, focusing in on the LNT, but nuclearmatters.org is an organization that I find very reputable and has a lot of useful information for those who are interested about nuclear power and next generation nuclear technologies.
So you've been working in the field for 30 odd years. I don't know how much longer you intend to work, but is working in trying to change minds on LNT one of the major issues for you now?
Well, it is a passion of mine, but I got to keep it separate from what I actually do for a living. I work for a consulting firm, and I'm working for licensees who work with radioactive materials, and I do radiation safety training, and I do share my thoughts with my students. But I have become passionate about this issue because I think it's just incredibly important. And like you say, you know, I'm 30 years into my career, so I've certainly got a lot more of my career behind me than in front of me. And I figure that with as much time as I have left, to the extent that I could educate people about this topic, that's what I want to do. So when I attend conferences, I will often volunteer to give presentations about the LNT and why I think we need to get away from it. So I take every opportunity I can to do that sort of thing. And I hope to be able to continue to do that for a long time.
Well, what I may do on my side is I'll try and find one of those scientists who is very pro-LNT and have a podcast with them and see how they present that information.
There you go. And then you could bring us back together and we can just slug it out.
Yeah, I'll have you as the guest host and you can tackle.
Yeah, that would be fun.
So, Dr. Feldman, this was very informative, very interesting, and you mentioned so many things that, you know, we could have pursued and gone for much longer on. So maybe in the future we come back again and address some of those other topics that you mentioned along the
way.
Okay. But thank you very much for taking the time with me today.
You're very welcome.
Special thanks to our host, Dr. Ramsey, and to our guest, Dr. Fellman, for joining us on today's episode of VersingCast. If you or someone you know has a project or expertise you think would make a good topic for our show, visit versantphysics.com/podcasts to introduce yourself or leave a comment on today's episode. We'd love to hear from you.